Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith, and I want to tell you about my book, Wayfarer, Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences, and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.
On this month's Wonder Woman podcast.
And it is really like a sea of sexual soup. It's just you've got all this mix of different eggs and sperm.
I meet the man who is doing his best to encourage sex on the Great Barrier Reef as he tries to regenerate sections of dying coral. I also undertake a brand new walk in Tasmania, which is the first Aboriginal owned and operated guided hike in the country. Not bad for a place for which the Indigenous peoples were said to be extinct right up until the 1970s.
A lot of people would look at me and never take me to be an Aboriginal person. That's because I've got blue eyes and fair skin.
And I catch up with my fellow Wonder Woman, Keris Matthews, to find out why she's now an outdoor gear convert.
I'm really late to the Pepper world, but it's now May, beautiful day. I am still reluctant to leave my Pepper in the house when I go out.
Brilliant.
Because Ian is your bed with you.
Also coming up, how you can save money when booking your next flight with my hard-won travel hack. Prepare to be in awe as I reveal the best natural phenomena to catch around the world. And, with my wonderful podcast partners Rohan, talk the best travel gear for a life on the road. Finally, I'll be revealing this episode's Wonder Woman of the Month, the traveller whose name is lost to the history books. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, an audio travel magazine with me, Phoebe Smith, exploring off-the-beaten-track destinations, wild spaces, wildlife encounters, and the unsung heroes behind conservation efforts. Come wander with me.
Yapalingana, Wukalina Tu, Pakana Takara, Mulaka Lumi, Manta Manta, Warata Takara, Milathena, Warata, Tanapri, Pakana, Ningani, Ningana, Ningatu. So hello and welcome to Wukalina. Our old people roamed and hunted here for a long, long time. As we walk together over country today, we will share the culture of our people with you.
You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, and I'm here in Tasmania and have just started out on the Wukalina Walk, which is the first Aboriginal owned and operated walk in Australia. And I'm here with my guide Carlita, who you heard before giving us the acknowledgement to the area that we're in. I think the first question has to be, so many of us are taught that the Aboriginal people of Tasmania were quote unquote made extinct, but that's simply not the case, is it?
No, definitely not.
I'm just going to stop this right here. You can probably hear the tone in Carlita's voice when I asked about Aboriginals in Tasmania. I remember when I first visited this place back in 2006, a guidebook I had with me clearly stated that there are no Aboriginal people left in the state. And I have to say, I believed it. I travelled around the place for nearly 2 weeks and certainly didn't see anything to make me think otherwise. But that's just it. You can't go on what you see. And that has been the problem for so many years here. I let an Aboriginal elder I met from the community explain how that happened.
Yes, well, when I was in, I reckon I was in grade four at school, there was no such thing as Aboriginals, Tasmanian Aboriginal people. They didn't exist. The last Tasmanian Aboriginal person died when Truganini died, and her partner, that was said to be the last Aboriginal people. Why they did that, I don't know, because there was a lot of Aboriginal people, Tasmanian Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
You know, still going. And from that community on Cape Barron, this is where we stem from today, Carlita and myself and like a lot of other people like us. It didn't matter that we came to Tasmania. It didn't make us any less Aboriginal.
Auntie Audrey, as she likes to be called, mentions of both Cape Barron Island and Truganini, a Tasmanian Aboriginal, are pertinent. There's conflicting reports about why Truganini did it, but when the Europeans came and many Indigenous people were being killed off by disease or murder, she is said to have encouraged them to relocate to a safe haven. That safe haven was the Fervo Islands off the northwest coast, and that's where Carlita and many of the last descendants of the Aboriginals grew up.
So I was born and raised on Cape Barron Island, as well as my mum and her family.
And what are your memories of growing up out there?
Very different to obviously living on mainland, as we call it, very small and a bit tight-knit community. So it was very small, and my school had only about 10 people in it, including primary school and high school put together.
And then the whole idea behind the Wukalina walk is to offer something a bit different. It's so that we can not only do a nice walk, but it's learning to see the landscape from, you know, your ancestors' eyes. So how did you feel when you first found out about the walk and you started to guide on it?
I was very amazed and overwhelmed by the people that wanted me to do it. And I thought it was absolutely amazing to start up a walk and to provide a four-day experience on country with myself and other Aboriginal guides, and to tell the history, you know, and say that we are still here. We might not be, you know, as dark as mainland folks, but we're still here and we still have our culture, and we are willing to share our culture and our history with people that want to learn about it.
Perfect. I can't wait to know more.
We meandered through a woodland, winding between the trees, where Carlita stopped several times to show me uses for various plants we spotted.
So yeah, I'll just stop you guys here. And here I have a Banksia tree, which these grow a little yellow bottle brush thingy on the edge of them.
Yeah.
And they come off really, really yellow. And what the old people used to do, they used to get a bunch of these and take them down and put it into hot water. So they would use obviously hot rocks to get that water hot. They'd place a bunch of these inside of the pot and let it sit for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then they'd take them out and you'd have a really nice, sweet, honey tasting tea.
What have we got here?
This is obviously a fern.
Yep.
And with this, we usually use it for an antiseptic. So you tear off the bottom bits here.
Yeah. So this is right down to the roots.
Yeah, all the way down to the roots. And you'll find this white sappy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So start to form like real sticky sap.
Oh, yeah.
And then if you got a cut or insect bite or anything, you just...
put that right on?
Rub that right on.
Can I smell it?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it even sort of smells that way, doesn't it?
By the time we reached a clearing and finished our ascent, I felt like I'd already become more attuned into the landscape.
And here we are at the summit of what was called and is still labelled as Mount William, but is actually Wukalina.
Yes.
What a view. I can see out to sea. Are these the islands we're looking at over here? So one of these are the ones you grew up on?
Yes, yeah, so it starts all the way from on your left and goes
Wow. It even looks like a peninsula. It looks like it could be joined to us.
Yeah, it looks like two or three different islands.
Yeah.
That's all one long island. And then through the mountain just there, you can see a couple more peaks of mountains at the back.
Yeah.
And that's actually Strzelecki on Flinders Island.
Wow. We're so lucky. We've got wall-to-wall blue sky. We have sunshine. In front of me, there's trees that we've just been walking through, and we've popped out above them on this boulder and are looking out to green plains that then breaks into white sand, it looks like.
Yeah.
Blue sea, and then off to mountainous islands.
It looks, a really good perspective. On this side, you have the white man's version of what the landscape should look like.
Yeah.
And you look to your left and this is what it really should all look like.
Yeah, because on I'll just describe it. So on this one side, it's very kind of manicured. Yeah. There's fences. A lot of the trees have been cut down.
And all in lines, and you can tell they're being planted.
Yeah, it's very man-made, evidently, because it's almost a bit too pristine. And then you look the other way and it just looks wonderfully wild, and I have to say, for me, much more inviting.
Yes.
We sat on that summit for a while, eating our food and simply gazing at the magnificently wild landscape. It would have been a perfect spot to linger longer, but we had a camp to get to, so we began our journey towards the sea. But that's not to say there wasn't some stops along the way.
Okay, so we're back in the woods and I thought we'd finish lunch, but you've stopped because you've found something for us.
Yes, I have. So here I have a bush tucker lamandra. So it's just a plant that grows really anywhere. Even you can find it in the suburbs these days as well.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a little bit like a snow pea.
Okay.
So it's kind of just a thirst clencher or something like that, just to cleanse your palate kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's white and...
And do you, what do? Eat it? Chew it?
So yeah, you just chew it on the...
Chew
the white bits and that's it.
Oh yeah, it does taste like a bit like a snow pea, yeah.
Yeah.
We raided nature's pantry a few more times, collecting sap from yucca trees to help with our fire later. It burns like coal. Grabbing some eucalyptus branches for the camp cleansing ceremony, more later. And even stopped to watch a rather fat wombat waddle out of the path ahead of us. By the time we arrived, I wasn't even so sure I was hungry.
So yeah, welcome to Kirkani Lumi. We've just walked about 9 km from the summit of Wukalina and we've just arrived at Kirkani Lumi. So Kirkani Lumi means place of rest. And yeah, so we're just taking a little bit of time out to just chill out and take all of the scenery in at the moment.
And we've got the fire going, yes. So we can hear the crackle of the wood. And we've got this gorgeous structure that is the camp, which is kind of this curved, everything seems to be made from wood. What's the thinking behind the design of it?
So the actual design of the dome structure and the huts itself came up on the concept of the traditional people living in dome huts around this area. So exactly in this area was the Truaway clan, and they all lived in dome huts, so they're all shaped like a dome and a circle. So that's how they got the concept of making their dome huts into like the traditional ways, and also it all being placed within a circle. So we're all ending up starting off at the elders, going pretty much in a big round circle all the way back to the same place that we started.
Despite being full with all my foraging, we ate even more food that night before being officially welcomed by Carlita around a fire in a traditional smoking ceremony, complete with some clapstick playing.
This is eucalyptus, like gum tree.
And why do we put the gum tree on the fire? What's the symbolic of?
So there's different plants we use for like different ceremonies, and the main one down here is to use eucalyptus, like gum tree, your common eucalyptus gum, and that produces a really nice white clean smoke.
Yeah.
And by playing the clapsticks as well, that's like letting our ancestors and stuff and the spirits know that we're here, and by cleansing you with the smoke, it's getting all of the bad energy and letting know that, you know, that's them also welcoming you here onto our land.
Once any negative energy was dissipated with the smoke, it was time to turn in. It was a wonderful place to stay the night. Despite it being winter and the temperature dropping so cold, I woke up to a layer of hoarfrost over the walkway in front of my dome. I left the tent door wide open, wanting to experience a night gazing at the stars and, maybe, being watched over by the ancestors.
Well, good morning from Palawar camp. I'm sat in my dome, just watching the sun come up, listening to the waves crash, hearing the morning birds sing, and toasty warm in my bed, and really feeling that I'm part of the bush.
My second day would see me and Carlita walk along a trio of bays, moving from scrub to sea. And I was soon to discover that there was as much of a bounty here as there was inland.
So here I've just found some quay reed, and you can get this in much more thicker form than what I have now. It can usually get about that round.
Okay.
And what I've heard that the ancestors used to use this for is actually to catch crayfish.
Ah.
So they would tie it together kind of like a big long rope, find a good crack in the water, so like where a cave and stuff is, where they know your crayfish is, they would then tie a bit of kangaroo or mutton bird on the edge of it.
Yeah.
And then they would dangle it down. And because these are actually flotation devices, so they obviously float. So when the crayfish actually hangs onto the piece of meat, it dangles. So then they know that it's been hooked onto something. So then they can slowly lower it up and by grabbing the crayfish.
Wow. So it's like a very early fishing line,
yes.
Really.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. A hand fishing line.
Carlita also pointed out the thick, leathery bull kelp used by Aboriginals as water carriers. Dried up cuttlefish skulls, whose black ink lines were used for face painting in traditional ceremonies, and stacks of middens, basically shell scraps from where the ancestors would sit by the sea and feast, leaving the rubbish as a sign to the next generation of what was available to eat here. But it wasn't just about what we saw. She also then told me a little more about the shocking past of a time when Europeans arrived and saw the Aboriginals as a resource rather than fellow human beings.
So up here, where I'm looking straight out of this little island right out in front of us, and that's called George's Rocks, or as we know it, Lana. And that island is where the women used to swim out and get the seals. So the men used to row them out in the canoes, drop them off for probably a whole day, and then they would actually light a fire on the highest point of Lana to let the men know back here that they're ready to be picked up with the seals. So the women in the clan, they used to send out the bigger women in the clan for more insulation, and also because they can more fit in with the seals. So they also used to rub themselves up in seal fat, like a wetsuit. And some recordings show that some of the women would be able to hold their breath for more than 5 minutes at a time.
Wow.
And be able to fully dive under like a seal and get that close up to the seal pups, where they'd be able to just knock them on their head with one of them waddies that I showed you last night.
Yeah.
So that's what also they were used for, was the seals.
Wow.
So, at times it would be sad, because when the sealers and stuff started to realise that the women were so good at what they were doing, they would then obviously take them onto their boats to utilise their skills. So the men back here would be seeing their family getting taken away, and once the sealers had finished with them, they would then either just leave them out there, or as they were trying to swim back to the boats, as soon as they would try and climb back on the boats, they would cut their hands off.
Oh my goodness.
So they would then obviously drown, but the men had to be standing pretty much where we are and just watching it all happen without...
It was a harrowing tale from Tasmania's past, but one that made the community here even more determined to tell their story, like they can do on the Wakalina Walk. Finally, we reached the lighthouse at the Bay of Fires, where we would meet Auntie Audrey once more. We told her about our adventure, and I told her just how much I'd learned from seeing the land through the eyes of her people. When I asked her if she was worried the Aboriginal culture here would be lost, she had a rather lovely response. So lovely, in fact, I think I'd rather she said it, as really, though she's talking about the Indigenous people in Tasmania, it's as relevant to any one of us.
We can go out in the world, we can do whatever we want, but we never forget where we've come from and who we are. There might be some, but I can't say that they would be happy people, because I really do believe before you can move forward, you've got to know where you've come from. And if you know where you've come from, you really do appreciate your heritage and your understanding. And then you can take that into the future with you.
That was me reporting from the Australian state of Tasmania, a place that delivered above and beyond what I expected. But something that doesn't always live up to expectations are airlines, particularly when you're trying to book a flight for a reasonable price. I'm a woman who loves a bargain, so here's my travel hack of the month: how to bag the best deal when booking a flight. Flying can be ludicrously cheap, but it can also be insanely expensive.
If you want to bag a bargain on your next flight, and I do urge you that with some of the money you save, you consider offsetting your carbon using a program such as the one found on the World Land Trust website, here's some top tips. The first, protect your history. You're not paranoid for thinking that a flight price has increased after searching it a few times in your web browser. Based on cookies in your browser and not the delicious chocolate chip variety, prices do increase when a particular route is repeatedly searched, as the site wants to scare you into booking the flight quickly before the prices get even higher. So search in private browsing mode, usually Command-Control-Shift-P, Firefox and Explorer, or Command-Shift-N on Google Chrome and Safari. The second, use a comparison site. I'm not sponsored by any, but I personally find Skyscanner to be a great one, as it can show you the cheapest month and the different price points on consecutive days, helping you plan your trip based on the price alone. The next one is ask a travel agent. It may sound strange in this day and age, but travel agents do have the power to give you competitive rates, especially if you're booking a whole package with them. Don't be afraid to pick up the phone either and actually speak to a human being. You'd be surprised what a personal touch can do to get you the absolute best deal. And they also get commission, so everyone leaves happier. Do consider bulk passes and stopovers. If you're heading somewhere far away, consider adding more stops to your trip, as you can actually save money this way. Icelandair, for instance, offers cheaper routes to North America if you stop over in Iceland, so you get to see another place and save the passenger tax. Or if heading to Asia, AirAsia offers very competitive flight passes, so you could see more of the continent en route to your ultimate destination. For Australia, consider a round-the-world pass, which can often be cheaper than doing a direct return. The next tip is go off-season. In our summer, in the Northern Hemisphere, few people bother heading to Australia or New Zealand as it's their winter. But flights are cheaper, accommodation more readily available and competitive, and there's an abundance of wildlife experiences to see that only happen in their winter. That's just one example. In short, don't go to places when everyone else does. Look to their off-season to bag a bargain. Consider departing from other cities. Don't always assume that you have to go from your nearest airport. Some flights are nearly half the price if going from a less popular destination. Think London Luton or Birmingham. So even though there's cost in getting there, the saving can make it worth it. And finally, why not take the train? Let's just remember that flying isn't the only way to go, and indeed it's certainly not the most environmentally friendly way to get there. Look at other options, from trains, which are a favourite of mine, to cargo vessels, and even by foot. Pilgrimage, anyone? There's other ways to travel that can make getting there an even bigger part of the adventure. Happy travels and happy bargain hunting, everyone. That was my travel hack of the month, the insider knowledge I offer every episode so that you can make the most of your adventures. Something that also needs a little human intervention right now is the awesome and beloved Great Barrier Reef, the largest living organism in the world. Climate change is causing more extreme weather events, rising sea levels and heating water temperatures, which has caused mass bleaching events, which is catastrophic for the health of the oceans and, with it, the health of our planet. But there is hope. I met Professor Peter Harrison, a man who wanted to talk sex and lots of it. Intrigued? I was. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, and I'm here in Australia, in Queensland, joined by one of my hidden heroes, Professor Peter Harrison. Hello.
Hi.
And I want to start because you're going to explain to me exactly what you've been doing out here. But first of all, for anyone who doesn't know, the Great Barrier Reef, the coral, we're all told it's important. What is it and why is it important to us?
Corals are the very foundation of the reef system. They're these really simple animals that have this amazing symbiotic partnership with literally millions of microscopic algae. That gives corals enough energy from the algae to grow really, really fast, and therefore they form the primary reef structure. So corals really are the foundation group on the reef, and that's why they're so super important. The Great Barrier Reef itself is vast. It's the largest collection of reefs anywhere on the planet. It's visible from space, and it extends for more than 2,300 kilometres along the Queensland coast. Within this vast area, the reef systems are interconnected, and they're interconnected because many of the organisms, including corals, produce juvenile stages that drift in the currents and move between the reef systems. And so what we're finding is that Coral reefs are naturally resilient when there are healthy coral communities producing literally billions of larvae, because even though very few of those larvae end up in a good space on a reef system, those that do and can survive actually create the next generation of corals.
And so corals are, well, we've seen the headlines, you know, the Great Barrier Reef, some people said, go see it before it's too late. You know, it's dying off. Is that true? And what is causing this?
It's true that the Great Barrier Reef has been severely impacted by particularly the marine heat wave and the mass bleaching events in the northern part of the reef in 2016 and 2017. Researchers have estimated that possibly around 51% of the corals that were present in those areas ended up being killed during those two marine heatwave events. And so that's pretty catastrophic for some of those reef systems. However, within those areas, there are still patches on some reefs of remaining corals. And what we know about that is that these corals are more heat tolerant than the ones that were killed. We also know that other parts of the Great Barrier Reef have intermittently been affected by other bleaching events. So even at Heron Island here, which has now got these luxuriant reef systems that are full of fish and other marine organisms, we know that in 1998, for example, there was a major bleaching event here and we lost about one quarter of the corals in some of those areas. But the system in the southern part of the Great Barrier Reef hasn't been so severely impacted by bleaching in recent years. And therefore, there is this natural resilience, this natural bounce back. We're hoping that some of the areas in the northern Great Barrier Reef will show some similar recovery. And we're hearing some reports of some juvenile corals being seen on some of those reefs. The problem is that the extent of the death of corals was so large in some of those areas that it's going to take many decades for those reef systems to naturally recover. And that's where thinking about human intervention to actually short circuit that long time frame is where I'm working.
And so you were showing me some pictures on your phone of this. So this is the coral spawning. So essentially giving birth in a way. And so tell me what that looks like and what it is to witness that.
Corals undergo these amazing spawning periods. They're relatively simple animals, but throughout the year, most of the branching corals on the Great Barrier Reef and elsewhere around the world are actually developing eggs, and they develop the eggs over 9 months. So the same gestation period as for the human baby. And so they invest a lot of energy and time in developing the eggs, and then the sperm also develop in many of them as well. Many of them are actually hermaphrodites. They produce both eggs and sperm. And on a relatively few nights each year, after full moon periods, after the sea temperature has warmed in spring and summer, we see what we call mass spawning events. And these are incredible. They consist of many, many corals from many different species, all spawning synchronously, producing literally billions of eggs and sperm. They float up to the sea surface, form this very big slick on the sea surface, and fertilization rates are often very high, and therefore you get the production of literally billions of coral larvae. And it is really like a sea of sexual soup. It's just you've got all this mix of different eggs and sperm from many of the same types of species, and they're all combining, and you end up with this amazing conglomeration of all these different larvae that are produced.
And you also showed me these pictures of, so what you're doing is, rather than just letting this larvae kind of flow as it normally would and probably get eaten by a lot of the sea creatures, you're actually capturing this in some rather interesting looking nets, shall we say.
Yeah, so it sounds a bit weird, but I've actually developed a thing called a spawn catcher. And so we've now developed that to reasonably large scale. So within a 5 by 5 meter frame, we put a mesh net, and then we put out 30 meter long floating booms, a little bit like you do to corral an oil slick in a port or something like that. So we've adapted those thought processes. And we know that when you're putting that spawn catcher in the pathway of spawn from a healthy reef system, which is what we've done in the northern Great Barrier Reef on one of the remaining patches there last year, we captured about 400 million eggs in that one little spawn catcher. And so the idea is that we capture the spawn. Instead of letting the spawn drift away off the reef, we retain it, we maximise the fertilisation rates, we increase the genetic diversity of the next generation, and we grow the larvae in pools on the reef in fine mesh so that they're not eaten by fish and all the other things that usually love to eat coral larvae. And when the larvae are ready at about 5 or 6 days old, we then release them in various ways back onto the dead reef. Some of those larvae settle and some of the settled larvae survive. And what we can see in all of the experiments I've done here on the Great Barrier Reef and in the Philippines in some related projects is that the rates of recruitment of new corals in the areas we put the coral larvae are significantly higher than in the control areas where we don't put larvae. And most of the controls are not actually getting any new corals into them.
And I think you said out of 14 different sites you've done it, you've all 14, you've had the success rate.
Yeah, we've got 100% success rate at the moment, which is very exciting. And it's been a deliberate process over a number of years now to actually prove it, first of all, at small scales using mesh enclosures. But the idea has never been to retain it just in small scales. We want to actually develop a mechanism where we can have a real management impact and look eventually at kilometre scales. So just a couple of weeks ago in the Philippines, I was very excited because we added some new ideas to the way in which we're producing these coral larvae, and we got to hectare scales. So that's much greater than anyone else has done so far in the world.
So is that the main problem now? It's funding to be able to create something, perhaps something robotic, that will spread the larvae over huge areas.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we've proven the process from a scientific point of view, from an ecological point of view. We can absolutely guarantee that if you can capture spawn, grow larvae, wait until the larvae are ready to settle, put them on the damaged reef systems, which are not otherwise recovering naturally, then you can get a massive increase in the numbers of corals that quickly reform and start to generate a new population of corals. The problem now is the limitation is essentially funding to enable me to progress this from what we've got to now, hectare scales, to kilometre scales. And so we need some continuity of funding. When I'm not on the reef, I spend most of my time hunting for new project funding to enable new PhD students and other researchers to form these teams in different places and therefore try and scale this up to much more meaningful scales.
So it's all about sex and money?
Absolutely, just like life.
That was Professor Peter Harrison, pioneer of a kind of IVF for the Great Barrier Reef. I hope he manages to get more funding, as this could be a real game changer in the fight to save the reef. Speaking of natural wonders, it's time for my regular top 10 slot. And this episode, I decided to focus on natural phenomena you can see around the world. So get ready to be awed. In at 10, the Great Migration. Wildebeest, opportunistic lions, lurking crocodiles. As the seasons change in the Masai Mara and all goes dry, the wildlife has to move to feed. And with the great herds of wildebeest come the predators. Yes, lots of people go and see it, but there's a reason for it. There simply isn't anything else like it in the whole world. In at 9, the midnight sun. Imagine it being 10 o'clock at night and you suddenly feel like going for a walk, or a kayak, or a swim. Well, in countries far north, and far south too, this is a reality come summer for a couple of months, when they experience 24-hour daylight, or, as the Russians call it, white nights. Just think of the possibilities. In at 8, shooting stars. Though I'm not 100% sure that if you wish on one, your wish will come true, I can tell you that seeing one of these twinkling wonders careering through the sky will make you feel like they already did. In at 7, the green flash at sunset. Not just something from Pirates of the Caribbean. Go to many places around the world and you will hear talk of a mysterious green light that can be seen just as the sun goes down. Thought to be a refraction of the light on the horizon, I've seen it once in Australia on Dirk Hartog Island, and though I was just at the site of the last sunset in Australia, I felt like I really could have been at world's end. In at 6, the cuttlefish aggregation. Another Aussie one for you. Cuttlefish, sort of like squid, they do this amazing thing whereby they change colour as camouflage and to attract a mate. So I'm afraid, yep, more sex again this episode. There's a tiny town called Wahala in South Australia, and it's the only place in the world where they know this to happen predictably enough to arrange the delightfully named Cuttlefest around it. The water may be cold, but the underwater action is seriously hot. In at 5, butterfly migration. Butterflies are amazing. Their colours, their fragility, but imagine seeing them in their hundreds, nay, their thousands, all flying together and gathering on the hanging vines. Well, you can, and all it takes is a visit to Mexico come the summer. In at four, a solar or lunar eclipse. No matter whether you see the moon disappear temporarily or the sun become obscured, either one of these phenomena is take your breath away fantastic. To make it happen, the stars have to quite literally align. But when they do. In at three, a cloud inversion, one of my absolute favourites. You need to head to the top of a hill or mountain to spot this one, but my God, it's worth the effort. Effectively, it's when the cold air in the valley meets the uncommon warm air high up and forms a blanket of cloud lower down, meaning that you can stand on a summit and feel like you're above the clouds, because really, you are. In at two, the Brocken Spectre. And I think I like this one because it's so fleeting. You can sometimes see it when you're in a plane, or sometimes when you're walking on a mountain and it's sunny and raining at the same time. It's basically when the sunlight casts your shadow onto some kind of vapour and it forms a rainbow halo around you. It's rare and it is incredible. In at one, it has to be the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis. Thought to be trails from the swish of a fox's tail in Norway, but explained away using photons and neutrons by science. However they are formed matters not. They are, quite simply, life-changing. And no matter how many times you witness them, they never get old. Ah, the Northern Lights. Still bring tears to my eyes every single time I see them. Something else that can also bring tears to a traveller's eyes is rain, especially when you arrive at your destination to be greeted by a lot of it. Thankfully, Wonder Woman podcast partner Rohan have the answer, as this month I'll be talking waterproof jackets. Welcome to the Wonder Woman gear slot presented in association with Rohan. This month I'm talking waterproofs. Once called anoraks or cagoules, we now get to feel super cool as we can simply say my outer shell, because technically that's what it is. Essentially the third layer that goes over your base layer in fleece to not only keep out the rain, but also the wind too. When buying one, you need to look for a fabric that's not only waterproof, but also breathable. Look for a three-layer fabric. Otherwise, you'll think you're getting wet from a leaking jacket when it is, in actuality, because you're sweating inside and causing a microclimate of your own. You need a hood, of course, that fits around your face well. Drawstring adjustable is best for this, especially if they have captures so they stop them flapping in your face. Look for an adjustable hem and cuffs to keep water and cold air out, a storm flap behind the zip to keep things watertight, and then a chin guard to make things more comfortable when the hood is fully up. I've been testing Rohan's Super Light Elite jacket. It's just 250 grams, and I am pleased to report it has all of the above and is lightweight to boot, making it the perfect accessory to take with you and wear on your travels, even if you're not sure whether or not it will rain. Happy showers. Thanks very much to my friends at Rohan for supporting Wonder Woman on her travels. Do check out their website, rohan.co.uk. And remember, Wonder Woman listeners get a 10% discount at the checkout by using the code WWN9. That was my monthly dose of gear talk for you. But before you grab your own waterproof and head out for a walk in the rain, there's a little more gear talk coming up with my guest. I caught up with Catatonia frontwoman and BBC radio presenter Keris Matthews, who, after a few wild camps and hikes with me, a trip to a gear shop and a recent birthday trip to Nepal, has completely converted to outdoor clothing. I caught up with her for a glass of wine and a chat about mountains, Everest Base Camp, and the joy of a good duvet jacket. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, and I'm joined by one of my favourite Wonder Women, fellow Wonder Women, Keris Matthews. Hello, Keris.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good. And we're sat in your garden on a lovely day, I think, slightly overcast, but really nice and warm. And you're not long returned from Nepal, which we'll talk about in a minute. But first of all, the outdoors travel, can you remember your first experiences of that?
So it was in a place called West Cross, which is between Swansea City Centre and Mumbles. And it's, if anyone is familiar with the area, it's behind Dick Barton's chip shop, which is really good for curry sauce and scallops and chip patties. But anyway, behind the sort of like city stroke suburban normal house was this little woods. And to me, it was the world. you could go there and you could forage and find nettles and all sorts of mushrooms and, you know, just get an idea of the things that you could eat, like the sticky grass stuff. And yeah, I think that's what really got me interested in the natural world in a way. So although I was brought up as a sort of city child, I always loved being outside.
You had that experience as a child, and then obviously when you got older, you were singing, you were in a band, you were touring. Was that then your sort of first experience at far-flung travel?
Well, as soon as I was legally able to, I went off with a rucksack on my back, and that was, my father was massively into Spain. And I think that as a parent, you don't know how much you influence your children, but you influence them so much. My dad was like in Spain, and I ended up, the first country I wanted to go when I was legally able to was Spain. So I put a rucksack on my back and went off to try and find out more about music, primarily like flamenco music and guitar playing. So that was probably my first big adventure, because I just turned 18.
And obviously you would have travelled when you were touring with Catatonia. Did you actually get to see many of the places you were in, or was it just like gig to gig, hotel room to hotel room?
Yeah, for my shame, because considering all the places we visited, it really was like, by the end it was like you'd arrive, you get through the airport, you'd arrive at the hotel, you'd unload, you'd either go straight to sleep, because you'd know it was a nighttime kind of vibe. And then you'd go and do the gig, or you'd go and do the festival. Then you'd probably stay up because you're so hyper after the show, way into the early hours. Then you'd go to bed, and then you'd stay in bed until you were roused by the tour manager. So I'd go, come on, we've got to move. So yeah, so it was brilliant. But the best place I remember as part of the sort of touring thing was Japan. For whatever reason, that was probably, I don't know, body clock or something, but I just remember being in the really clear streams at the bottom of the Fuji mountain, and there were gorgeous pebbles at the bottom, and just pulling your socks and your shoes off and put your feet in the bottom of the stream and thinking, oh my gosh, this is incredible, and having Fuji mountain, you know, by your side. That was probably the wildest sort of memory I've got of all those 10 odd touring years of, you know, intense touring years, at least, because I was doing it for about 20 years in total.
And then when we met, and you asked me to take you out sort of back into the wild, and we went on our first wild camp, and then that led on to other sort of adventures, what was it that kind of got you wanting to get back out there and actually experience place on a different level and get back into nature?
I think there's a lot of us at the minute that are so like making no sense of the logic of day-to-day existence of social media and politics, and you know, we are so privileged to be living in this era, 2019. You know, we have not had a war on our doorstep for decades, and we have food to eat, and we have a health package and a network of, you know, safety nets. And yet we're so far away from that sort of basic ability to look after ourselves as an individual, and our respect and love for nature. And there seems to be a lesson in that, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I think unregulated capitalism thrives on us feeling dependent. And I, for one, feel like questioning and that, and trying to free myself from the shackles of it, if that makes sense.
It does. And certainly that's what draws me to the outdoors, is just disconnecting from all that and reconnecting with something much more primal. How did you find going up Snowdon? Because obviously I took you and the kids up there, and I didn't realise until we were going there that it was your first time up to the top. How did you find that experience?
Oh, it was superb. Because, you know, I'm, you know, born and bred in Wales. You know, there's no hiding away from the accent and stuff. But I'm from South Wales. I'm a South Wales mongrel. And I've never been up Snowdonia. So to go up, but more so to go up with you as a guide, to be fair. So I didn't have any of the worries of the logistics and the safety of getting lost. Because as a touring musician, I always had a tour manager, which meant I am a lemming. I will walk off a cliff because I've got no sense of direction. So thank you for one.
You're welcome.
And I was bringing my three children with me. So a 15-year-old, 13-year-old and a 9-year-old. So I just wanted to be sure that they were safe so I could just enjoy myself. And I don't like heights. So there was all those things to consider. So you enabled us to get up there, and it's actually changed our outlook considerably, because since then we've been up to Everest Base Camp and we're now looking for the next adventure, really. And we're all more outward looking, I think, as a result.
And tell me about the Everest Base Camp trek, because I know you've just recently come back from that. How did you find Nepal and how did you find seeing the Himalaya?
Strangely enough, having been up Snowdonia so recently, it really did inform our enjoyment of the Himalaya. Because in terms of when you're starting out, you have no idea about kit. You just don't have an idea, really. I didn't anyway. And so just to know what you can carry, what you need, the water, how things work, how things feel, rest times, you know, everything really informed it. But the Himalaya, just off the scale in terms of everything. People, welcome, beauty, the changes. Because you don't, that's the thing, everyone goes, oh, was it difficult? Not really, because although you were hiking between 7 and 9 hours a day, kind of, it wasn't boring at any point, because this is what you can't factor in. Everything changes. The weather changes on the sixpence, and the botany, the flora and the fauna change as well, so that you're never bored. You just literally, everything changes, and there's lovely people around you all the time as well. So it's if you listen to this, don't hesitate. And we actually passed an 81-year-old on the trek as well.
Wow.
So even if you can't do the whole trek, you can do some of the trek.
Yeah, and it's, you can
worth
do something.
It, because
yeah,
it takes so much away with you.
And you don't need to go that high to see those views of the Himalaya,
no,
is the thing.
Oh my gosh. Well, we landed on the 5th, started trekking on the 6th, flew into Lukla that day and started trekking. And we didn't see the Himalaya until the 11th. I mean, not the Himalaya. We didn't see Everest until the 11th. And then it's so far away. But you're in the middle of this massive range, because there's I'm not going to make up a statistic, but the vast majority of Nepal is the Himalaya.
Yeah.
So you're already in the middle of it. But what it doesn't teach you is how many days of hiking and trekking to get to even those peaks, the inner sort of sanctum of the Everest area.
Yeah.
It's bonkers.
And so you said you're thinking of the next adventure. Any ideas of the kind of thing you'd like to do?
No. No, I think, but all of us, we've got all the gear now. My husband has got rid of all his clothes, apart from his mountain clothes.
So it's really changed you all.
Once you get rid of the sort of leather boots and things, and you're into trainers and walking boots, it's a turning, isn't it?
Oh,
don't turn
totally.
Back.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you've got all this gear, you've got to walk.
And so finally, I'd say, what is after your experience in Snowdonia, the experience at doing base camp trek and wearing your outdoor clothes virtually every day, what's the one piece of kit you now couldn't do without?
I love, do you know, it sounds terrible, I love my puffer jacket.
Do you?
And I'm really late to the puffer world, but it's now May. Is that a blackbird you can hear?
I think it is, yeah.
It's a beautiful day. I am still reluctant to leave my puffer in the house when I go out.
Brilliant.
Because it's your bed with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You could just walk anywhere in the world and you're there. Safe, sound, secure, warm and comfortable.
Perfect. Oh, thank you so much, Karis. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
No, I owe you everything. But here's the next adventure.
Oh, definitely. Bring it on. That was Karis Matthews and me chatting in her garden earlier this spring. I find her growing love of the mountains and travel utterly inspiring. Do check out her brand new book, Where the Wild Cooks Go, which has just been published, for more of her wonderful words, poems, memories, and food. Mm-mm. Well, from one Wonder Woman to another, it's nearly the end of the episode, so finally time for me to share with you my utterly incredible Wonder Woman of the Month. I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe so you never miss an episode. And do consider leaving a review. It really does help. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Phoebe R. Smith. Go to my website, phoebe-smith.com, where you can sign up for my monthly newsletter and never miss a trick. And of course, do check out my friends at rohan.co.uk, where you can enter the code I gave earlier at the checkout to get a discount off your order. Now, without further ado, here's the traveller who should be a household name, but few have heard of. Introducing my Wonder Woman of the Month. Running like a ribbon along the length of the east coast of the USA, there is, deep in the forest, a long-distance footpath. Famed by travel author Bill Bryson in his celebrated book A Walk in the Woods, the Appalachian Trail spans a serious 2,000-mile, that's 3,500 kilometres, route from Georgia and the peak known as Springer Mountain to the summit of Katahdin in Maine. En route, it passes through what is affectionately called the Green Tunnel, traversing 14 states, mainly in the trees. It was completed in 1937 and first hiked in its entirety by a man called Earl Schaefer, aged 29, in 1948. His name is legendary within thru-hiking circles and beyond. In fact, when he died in 2002, he was honoured with an obituary in the New York Times. However, there was a woman whose name is not so very well known and wasn't given the same treatment. Her name was Emma Gatewood. At the young age of 67, this mother of 11 and grandmother and even great-grandmother of many more decided in 1955 to hike the AT alone in a single season. Setting off in just a pair of canvas Keds trainers and foregoing the comfort of a tent and simply telling her family she was going for a walk, she became the first woman to hike it all solo. At the time, being a lone female caught the attention of local press, who nicknamed her Grandma Gatewood. A pioneer of ultra-lightweight hiking, she not only inspired a generation of women to get outside and walk, but also others to spurn all the heavy trappings of modern gear and go with minimal kit. Having suffered a life of abuse at the hands of her husband, she often sought the wilderness as a means of escape. But it wasn't until she saw an article in National Geographic magazine that her interest was piqued in the trail. Her first attempt in 1954, going north to south, saw her frequently get lost, and she was rescued by rangers who told her to go home. To avoid them, she set out the year after, but this time from Georgia, with a small string bag, which in it she kept among limited supplies, a notebook and pen, but no sleeping bag. Instead, she slept under benches, on porch swings, and even on the cold ground. She succeeded her trailblazing hike in 146 days, averaging 14 miles a day, which given that now many youngsters take 6 months to do, is an incredible feat. For doing all that people said she shouldn't, for being a survivor in so many ways, and for rough sleeping along the way, we have to give a hearty Wonder Woman salute to this most remarkable lady. And that's why Grandma Gatewood is this episode's Wonder Woman of the Month. In the next episode of the Wonder Woman podcast, all aboard as I set sail on a cargo boat in Quebec to experience a taste of life, literally beyond the end of the road. I'm left in awe by light artist Bruce Munro, whose Field of Light installation is the only thing to almost upstage the mighty Uluru in Australia. I talk folklore and legends by bringing you the most mesmerising mythical creatures around the world, tell you all you need to know about buying the most versatile travel top, and share my tips for how to make your trip last even longer, and much, much more. See you then. Wonder Woman out. The Wonder Woman podcast is written and edited by me, Phoebe Smith. The producer for this episode is Daniel Nielsen. The wonderful logo was designed by John Summerton, and the photograph is by Claire Rodley. Thanks to our partner Rohan, and a final thanks to all the people I met on my journey and were willing to talk to me. It's because of you that this podcast is able to happen at all.
Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith, and I want to tell you about my book Wayfarer, Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again, by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences, and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.